There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan.
My brother from another mother.
On FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
1207 FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile, Friday style. Glad to have you all along. And if you're new around here, it's easy to get in touch with the show. One number, two great ways to communicate. 251-343-0106. 251-343-0106 gets you through on a phone call or a text. In addition to that, but wait, there's more. You can go to the FM Talk 106.5 app and you'll see that microphone icon on the front page. If you press that, let you record a message, you can email it to the show, play it back here on the air. So use those and enjoy them over the next couple of hours. And good to get this man on in hour number one. And I've got questions for him. I mean, he's in the news. If you look at public safety and crime and punishment out there, he's in the news. But he's even more in the news when it comes to this week about funding for the district attorney's office. Keith Blackwood, good to see you.
Good to see you, Sean. Thanks for having me.
And we had a little discussion, you and I and Dan, this morning, but I want to revisit a lot of that. First of all, before we get into what's made news from Tuesday on here, you were mentioning this morning that you'd been up in Montgomery.
That's right.
And in a committee, supporting a bill in a committee. And then you and I were talking about it during the news. This was one, y'all, we talked about earlier in the week, and I read the words, but I didn't know exactly what it meant. And this is that DUI bill that Marcy Wilcox is carrying, right?
That's right.
The story gave example of two situations, and then how it was different charges. Can you kind of help me? Because I'm lost in this.
Sure. This is one bill that fixes two laws. And your confusion's understandable. The first time this went to a committee in the legislature, there was a lot of confusion as well. But we did a lot of work educating our legislature on what this does. And the second time it went through the Senate Judiciary Committee, it sailed through. I went Wednesday and testified at the House Judiciary Committee meeting and explained the entire bill. It was passed through committee unanimously. No one had any questions for me because of the way I laid it out. But I can.
That's what I need.
I need to clear that up for you.
Yes, the explanation, legislative explanation for dummies. I'm your dummy.
Sure.
So let her rip here.
So the first part of this will amend our manslaughter statute to put driving while under the influence and causing a death squarely within the manslaughter statute. Before, we relied on the Section A1, the general one, reckless conduct that causes a death. There's precedent for this with driving under the influence because we've now done it with fentanyl and distribution of fentanyl that causes a death. That is squarely within the manslaughter statute. This will place driving under the influence while intoxicated, or driving under the influence and causing a death, squarely within the manslaughter statute. The reason it's needed is because right now under Alabama law, there is a lesser included to that called criminally negligent homicide while driving under the influence. That is only a Class C felony. And so in this particular case, in May of 2020, there was an 18-year-old girl named Devaney Rooney. She was going to a graduation event, killed by a drunk driver. The case was tried. The jury came back guilty of criminally negligent homicide while driving under the influence. Defendant was punished for a Class C felony, where if Devaney had lived and had been seriously physically injured, then the defendant would have been punished for a Class B felony, assault first DUI. That makes completely no sense.
Right.
And so the first part of this bill is to fix driving while under the influence.
How did that end up in the law? It just layers of old paint or something like that?
It must have been, because you look at the case law in defining what criminal negligence is, and to me, having done this for as many years as I have, it makes no sense. To practically explain it, it would be criminal negligence is you did not know that there was a risk that a result would occur, but you should have known. And you apply it to the facts of a case like this. You drink alcohol or take drugs and you're under the influence and you don't know that if you get behind the wheel, you could cause a death, but you should have known.
Yeah.
That makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, there's nobody left on that list that doesn't know that.
That's right. And so this bill would put driving while under the influence and causing a death squarely within manslaughter as reckless conduct. There was a risk, you knew there was a risk, and you took that chance anyway. That's what recklessness is.
Like you did with the fentanyl, because you said if you're dealing the fentanyl, you know this could cause a death.
Correct. And if other circumstances exist, we're not prohibited from seeking extreme indifference murder, which is a Class A felony. So if you have other circumstances that would justify that charge, this bill would not prevent us from doing that.
Now, the first thing you said, though, too, that stuck out that what an eye-opener, that if she would have survived,
right,
the charge against the person who ended up killing her, if she survived, would be a high, it'd be a
it
B.
Would be a Class B felony.
But because she died, it's assault. A C.
He was charged with the B felony manslaughter, and because this lesser included exists and had the jury had to be instructed on it, that's the one they chose to convict him of.
Which is a
C felony. So he got a lesser charge than if Devaney would have lived.
I mean, you're somebody this has dedicated your life to law. And understand, imagine just regular citizens hear that and go, how'd that happen? I mean, how did we get that kind of situation in the law?
It's been the law in the books since I started my career. It's one that has always bothered me. I have tried a lot of these traffic homicide cases. I prosecuted them. And To have a Class C felony where a death was caused by what is reckless conduct, I don't care what the law says about criminal negligence, it's reckless. To have that has been very frustrating. And so we had this opportunity to work with Representative Wilcox, Senator Sessions, and the families that this bill has affected. And I think this bill has a lot of momentum in Montgomery right now.
Okay. So this will be, obviously, when you're up there, you're talking to voting members of the Congress here, and they're saying they're as close as telling you they got you got the vote?
I think I feel good about it. It passed the Senate already, the full Senate. That happened yesterday.
And they don't like anything.
And it goes before the House early next week, I believe on Tuesday. And there's a second part to this bill that fixes something else in the law that I've never thought made a lot of sense, having to do with leaving the scene of an accident.
That was another part I read in the story. Okay, that one also confused me, so help me here.
Right. So leaving the scene of an accident causing injury or death is a Class C felony under current law. If no injury or death occurs, it's an A misdemeanor. So in effect, if someone is intoxicated, they know they're under the influence, right now the law encourages them to leave the scene of an accident because
a perverse incentive to flee.
I believe the law incentivizes people to leave the scene because they know if they stay and a death has occurred, they could be charged with a Class B felony of manslaughter, or Class A extreme indifference murder. To leave the scene of an accident, we're never going to be able to prove they were intoxicated. If we can connect them back to the car and show that they left, then the most that they face would be a Class C felony. And that's exactly what happened in February of 2023 with John Wesley Holt, who is also honored in the name of this bill. He was walking down the side of Old Shell Road when a defendant driving a car struck him. John Wesley was a pedestrian. He was struck by this vehicle. The defendant got out of the car, looked at him dying on the side of the road, got back in, and fled the scene. Jeez. 5 days later, he's arrested, and then the most that we could charge him with was leaving the scene of an accident, causing injury or death, a Class C felony.
Wow. So that that's going to amend that as well.
It will amend that as well to make to be consistent with the other. If this passes, then leaving the scene of an accident causing death or serious physical injury would be a Class B felony. With physical injury, it would remain a C felony, and if there's no injury, then it would remain an A misdemeanor.
Yeah, we're talking about moving things up in class as well. Remind me of the discussion about the shooting into, changing that as
right.
well. I mean, it's that same kind of discussion, right?
Something it is
a class, and I don't know what is a C and move into a B or B to an A.
It went from a B to an A where you have an occupied building or occupied vehicle, and that was absolutely necessary because that is one of the most dangerous things that someone can do, just shoot into an occupied dwelling or vehicle. So many deaths have been caused by that.
Yeah, and I mean, and innocence.
Right. Innocent children many yes. times sleeping on the couch in the living room.
Doing things that people are supposed to do.
Right.
Like sleeping in their house and eating dinner.
Exactly. I've seen it too many times.
All right. We come back from the news break here. I want to talk about what story has been getting a lot of traction this week. And what about funding for your office going forward here, city versus county versus the state of Alabama. We continue our conversation with Mobile County District Attorney Keith Blackwood next.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 1220 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Friday. Glad to have you all along and great to have District Attorney Keith Blackwood in studio. You mentioned something, too. There's one other part of this. Y'all, this whole, I had a word for it. I used this whole grouping of law here that we're working at changing is a piece of crap, to be honest with you, because you said this about restitution. What was it that you're...
Yeah, well, I'm just happy to have the opportunity to have an impact and improve a law like this. But right now, the current leaving the scene of an accident with injury or death law, as it's written, does not comprehend those that are injured or killed as actual victims under the law. Because the way it's written, the crime is not causing a death or an injury. The crime is the fact that the offender left the scene without rendering aid,
but they
without
left
providing
the dang
ID.
Scene because they killed or injured somebody.
Right. It's a poorly written law. And so victims have not been entitled to restitution after convictions under leaving the scene of an accident. And there's a case that goes all the way back to 2001. The Court of Criminal Appeals addressed this, and they came to that conclusion under the law, and they didn't want to, but they had to because that's the way the law was written. They actually encouraged the legislature to fix that in the law, and this bill does that.
Okay. I now have an understanding that I did not have about this law. It's super important. I kind of didn't understand it. Now I understand how important it is and just embarrassed that we let stuff like that sit on the books.
Well, I encourage everybody, contact your legislators and support this bill.
And thanks for explaining it in regular people language.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. All right, let's talk about financing for your department here.
Sure.
And first of all, the stats we talked about this morning, I've read this week, yeoman's task y'all have done at getting the caseload down. Give us some raw numbers. Like, what was it and what is it now? And
yeah, when I started, we were just under 10,000 cases pending in circuit court alone. That doesn't include what's in grand jury, what's in district court. I use circuit court as the metric because that's the trial court. We went to the city and the county, asked for some additional resources. We hired some more prosecutors. In a year, we got through the COVID backlog. The backlog started before that. As I said this morning, I believe in about 2016. And after 3 years, we are halfway through what we had.
You started with how many?
We started with almost 10,000.
Felony.
Mostly felonies. There's a few certified misdemeanors in there, but we're down around 5,000. Now, that doesn't mean that we've handled 5,000 cases. That means we are handling the thousands of cases that are coming in each year. There are cases going out, and we've reduced that overall pending number by half.
But there's this nuance, too, right, that because y'all are being able to seat juries and do this,
right,
people that before were not going to plead.
Right.
Now we're going, that helps it some too, right?
It does. When we weren't able to have jury trials, there's absolutely no incentive for anybody to resolve a case in any way. our backlog became exponentially worse than it was from prior to COVID, became worse during COVID and in the aftermath of that. But this has really been a 10-year process of the caseload building up to where it was when I took office, and then able to get those resources, hire prosecutors. I did some reorganization within the office to really attack it, and really that's what it took. So I would like to keep that progress going. I would like to see the numbers get back down to where when something horrible happens, we can get that case to trial in a year, year and a half, 2 years, instead of 3 to 5, 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, number one, for justice for the victims.
Right.
Number two, for public sentiment.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, the money that would made that, that was ARPA money, right?
From the county was able to give us $1.5 million over 3 years in ARPA money. That's COVID money, had to be spent to mitigate the effects of the COVID pandemic. We were able to do that because we could apply it toward the COVID backlog. That money ran out, and so I asked the city to make up for that with a little extra. I'm asking them for $1.1 million per year for the next 3 years. I believe there's a vote on that at city council tomorrow. Had a really good response from everyone in city council, from Mayor Charigatis over this week. So I'm very hopeful that we will be able to continue that partnership, continue the progress that we've made.
Probably doesn't hurt having a judge as a mayor.
I think Mayor Charigatis understands quite well. He was a judge. He was actually an assistant district attorney for some time, and I worked with him many years ago.
Without the funding, if it doesn't come through, and we're all hoping it comes through, what would you face? I mean, delaying cases, would you be laying off people? What are you looking at?
We would take a look and see what we could do. There would definitely be a tightening of the belt. There could potentially be some losses in positions of prosecutors. Definitely don't want that to happen. That would mean that our already overburdened prosecutors would have even more cases that they are responsible for. That means the cases are going to take longer. That means that the accused who are in jail are going to stay in jail longer while they're awaiting trial. And so to keep this progress going is good for Mobile, is good for Mobile County. We've seen over the last 3 years a decline in violent crime year over year, and this is a big part of that. It's not the only thing. Our police department has done a fantastic job. Mayor Stimson's administration, now Mayor Charigatis' administration, are very focused on this, and there's a lot that goes into it, but this is a very important part for keeping the crime rate down and in decline.
Okay, so I'm going to ask this question. Coming off the fact that there was ARPA money that got us to this point, now you've got the asking for this additional funding here. Is that just stopgap? Or what's the real number? Does that just get us down? Do we have this issue again in 3 years? What's the real number? Is it 1.1?
It is a stopgap, okay. And we could very well have this problem again in 3 years. But my hope is, and I'm optimistic, that in working with our legislature, we can have an overall sustainable funding fix, not just for Mobile County, but for every judicial circuit.
The other 66, it affects the rest of the state, DAs the rest of the state.
It does. There are 41 judicial circuits in the state, and this affects every single office.
Y'all get
statewide.
Financed, I know we said this morning, people weren't listening, from the state level, it's like, what, 20%?
I think I said 30% okay. This morning. I misspoke. In 2024-25, now that I have my paper in front of me, it was 20.7%
from
the state.
A fifth of your funding, right. That's it, that comes from Montgomery.
That's right.
How do you make up the rest of it?
We make up the rest from county funds. The county funds over 50% of our office. That was before the ARPA money over the last 3 years. We make up from it with grants, with court fees. We have a restitution recovery unit that used to make money, but now we actually
loses.
We lose a lot of money on it, but it's still a service to the victims, to the community, so I keep it. Bad check fees used to be a big source of income.
I told y'all, if you want to help, go write some bad checks, because That's not a thing anymore.
It's not, but we still provide that as a service because there are still bad check writers out there, and they're victims that have lost money through that, and so we want to be able to help them out, so I keep that. But we are a state agency. We're the only one that I'm aware of that's not fully funded by the state. When I went to Montgomery about that bill, I also talked to several legislators about DA funding, and the sense I get is that the vast majority of them want to help us out. They want DAs to be fully funded. It's a matter of trying to find that source of money because statewide DAs have to raise $70 million every year just for operating expenses to be at the status quo.
Beyond the 20% from the, or including the 20% from the state.
Right. It's at 70 million dollars.
On top of
what the state funds us.
So, I mean, I'm no math magician here, but I'm looking at, the 1.1 is not enough. I mean, fully funded is going to have to be a higher number than that, whether it comes from the state or
The 1.1 I'm asking from the city is important to keep the progress going that we have now. To fully fund DA's offices, that's not even what I'm talking about. This is just keeping the status quo. To fully fund us would require a lot more.
All right, coming right back with the district attorney right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:35, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. And just as the numbers get worse for DA's offices across the state. You said 70 million. It's actually 77.
77 million.
Million. Oh my gosh.
52,443.
Wow. I'm going to grab some text here, too. This one from David said, would the district attorney be okay with a compromise vote by the city council where they extend the $1.1 million funding for the next year, which would allow the county legislative delegation, the city council, the county commission, and himself enough time to sit down and figure out a permanent funding solution for his office without them having to go back to the city?
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable compromise at first, and I've put a lot of thought into that. We are responsible for the administration of justice. That's our purpose within this system. If we had 1 year assurance of this funding, then I'm afraid our number one export would be resumes. That's not something that I want to happen. We need stability. If we were to get 3 years like we're asking for, that gives us a lot more stability than a year. And if we can work together to fix this problem in a year, then I would not take additional funds from the city if the state is funding me.
Okay. So, I mean, this is two things. Is what's going on here at the city level. Also, let your members of the legislature know you want to fund your district attorney's office.
Absolutely. I think we all need to be working together with the legislature. I mean, they're on our team. They want to fund us. We just have to find the source to get the money to fund offices across the state.
Yeah, well, you're talking in the first half of the hour, we talked about those legislative changes that you were supporting up in Montgomery. This from a Mobile police officer on the text line said, one of my first traffic homicide cases in the late 90s was a guy who had 18 previous DUI convictions. The 19th killed a 16-year-old girl. 18 convictions.
Yeah, that's horribly tragic. I don't know if that guy ever got behind the wheel sober. We have had some, I don't know the exact state of the law in the 1990s, but we do have felony DUI now. So after so many DUIs, it becomes a felony. And also, were a scenario like that to happen today, if a person was killed because of a drunk driver with so many DUI convictions in his past, then we would charge that Class A extreme indifference murder. We've done that several times over the course of my career with people who have a prior DUI history and some other things. So that is absolutely unacceptable. I hope we never see another situation like that again.
Horrible. Squirrel Vereen says, how many of the prosecutors who left or leave the DA's office leave to become criminal defenders as opposed to leaving to do something else or prosecute somewhere else? Is that considered a violation of trust?
No, it's not a violation of trust. People leave the DA's office all the time and go into other fields. Some become criminal defense attorneys. There are some ethical standards that apply with confidentiality and agency communications and things like that. But there's it's not a violation of trust for a prosecutor to do that. You know, there are two main career paths for people that come to the DA's office, especially fresh out of law school. You've got people that want to come get trial experience because that's where you're going to get it. And then they want to go out and work in the civil world or in criminal defense. Take that experience and try to build a career there. And then you've got people like me that want to be career prosecutors and do this as a career for life. Yeah.
Michael said, my recommendation for the city council coming up with the money for the DA's office is to simply quit handing out money to offset the dumb choo-choo nobody is using and send that to the DA's office. So the numbers kind of line up on that between both there. Yeah, if you look at I think you're going to get the majority of people on the street. If you said, what is our hierarchy of needs for government? Public safety is going to be the top. That's why we have government.
Every level of government, the top priority should be keeping the citizens safe.
You know, I wonder, too, because I think people need to call their members of the legislature. You said that they're hearing you when you're up there talking, because I wonder if you give this with the city. If the city does this, are the state folks going to say, well, the city's got it, try to shift the responsibility away from doing what they should do?
I don't think so, because there's not a scenario where this funding from the city and local sources is going to be absolutely permanent. The only way that we can be permanently funded as a state agency is if the state steps up and does it. We're in a unique position in government. I think all the DAs across the state would agree with me. No matter what funding we get, no matter what resources we get, if it's not enough, we are still going to bend over backwards to get the job done. And we have done that for so many years. And I think in the past, maybe lawmakers knew that, and they knew that if they didn't fully fund us, we're still going to get the job done. There is a much better way. And I think our lawmakers are starting to realize that, and I think over the next couple of years, we're going to see some real solutions out of Montgomery.
I don't know if you know what they do outside of Alabama. Do other states do it differently?
Yes, there are some states we've looked at that fully fund their prosecution offices. We've had those talks through our association with lawmakers here in Alabama. It is different state to state. There are different systems, but the caseloads that we have, especially in our cities, the caseloads are absolute crushing caseloads for each individual prosecutor. But like I said, the ones of us that are called to do this, we're going to get the job done.
You've talked about this, though. We talked about some this morning, and you did mention it on the David suggestion for just 1 year. It's a morale issue, too. And you talked about this morning, you used the term burnout.
Yeah.
Burnout for prosecutors.
Yeah, that's a real thing. We've lost good prosecutors from our office to burnout.
You've lost some.
We have. They've gone to other careers. We've had some that have moved to offices out of state where the opportunities at work might be a little better.
This morning it was 6-1 caseload?
It's roughly six times the caseload per prosecutor that is recommended by the American Bar Association, other national organizations that look at these. When you look at indigent defense, the numbers of cases that any given attorney can handle in a year is limited. Ours is not. The average number of cases that a prosecutor in Alabama handles each year is over 1,100. I think the limit for indigent defense is about 200, 250. And that's just average. Here in Mobile, that's going to be much higher. Because as I said this morning, we are the busiest circuit prosecuting the most cases in the state of Alabama.
Wow. And you said funding there for indigent defense is what, 50? something million, 54, I think.
The funding for indigent defense, the last numbers that I have, they were funded $54 million.
Who funds them? Where do they get their
over
check?
Over and above. It's state funding. It goes through the Office of Indigent Defense. Wait,
so the state only funds the...
So it's a different mechanism going through the Office of Indigent Defense.
But they're fully funded at 54. They don't have to come up with that on their own?
From my perspective, I would say they seem to be fully funded. In Mobile, in I think this was fiscal year 23-24, for instance, from the state, indigent defense as a whole got about $12 million, and the DA's office got about $1.6 million. Now, that's not just for indigent defense for criminal defendants. Some of that is tied up in dependency cases at the Strickland Youth Center,
okay,
guardian ad litems to protect kids' rights in those dependency hearings, but the vast majority of that goes to criminal indigent defense.
And so it was 12-something million for that and for y'all 1-point-something.
That's right.
So, you know, if we're take the magic ball here, crystal ball, and look at this, what is that ratio like to fully fund? Okay, we're going to fully fund not just your office, but DA's office across the state. Is it 100% Montgomery? Is it 90% Montgomery, 10% local? I mean, what is, do you have a perfect scenario? Like, what does that look like? What's that number? What's the breakdown?
My argument, and there's disagreement about this with other DAs across the state. And
a bunch of attorneys arguing with each other.
Well, yeah, we're not monolithic. I mean, people have different opinions, as you can imagine. A room full of elected officials might. but my opinion is that we should be fully funded by the state. We are a state agency. As far as the state employing attorneys in other departments, we are the lowest paid attorneys in the state. We're not on the same scale as, for instance, the Attorney General's office, the Securities and Exchange Commission, other state employed attorneys.
Okay, so, these are some facts I didn't know.
Yeah, on average, our ADAs are much lower paid than other attorneys employed by the state.
Even though there's officials that will talk about how important public safety is to the state of Alabama. But this is not for you to say, this is me saying, but the dollars don't show me that.
Right.
That's an eye-opener there.
But again, we do this work because we love it. We care about our communities. We care about the safety of the people that we serve. It really is a calling to do this, and it makes for a fulfilling career. I don't want to turn anybody that might be graduating law school away from applying at the DA's office. You know, there are a lot of things that we have that nobody else does, which is the pursuit of justice, doing the right thing for the right reasons every single time.
Yeah, you probably get more satisfaction of something being black and white versus shades of gray, like in a civil situation.
Well,
or something like
there are still a lot of shades of gray in figuring out what the right thing to do is, but at the end of the day, we're going to do what's right. The shades of gray come into how difficult it is. It's mm-hmm. How difficult is it to do the right thing? And you know, what we have decided is we don't care how hard it is. We're going to do the right thing.
But that's a heavy lift. If I'm understanding what you're saying, it's that idea of, well, it might not be full justice, but we can get this. You know what I'm saying? It'd be easier if we just let them off on this. Is that kind of the shades of gray versus saying, no, the law says this?
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I think you're referring to maybe plea negotiations, mm-hmm. which I know a lot of people out there have opinions about that. That's a necessary part of what we do. We have to take into account the fact that, you know, we do have 5,000 cases pending in circuit court right now.
And new ones coming in every day.
New ones coming in every day. We have 8 courtrooms to try them in. We can't possibly take every single case to trial. Not every single case. You know, we might not want to take it to trial. There might be a good reason to settle a case. But in each and every one of those cases, we want to fashion a sentence that will hold the offender accountable, that will be good for the community. We don't have fire sales at the DA's office. We don't just give cases away. But that plea negotiation is it's absolutely a part of what we have to do because of the limited resources. We can't try every single case. I think I did a calculation one time. This was a year and a half ago. If we were to try every single case that was pending and not even count the ones that are still coming in, but try every single case, you average 3 days for a trial, which that was very conservative. Some of them go 4 or 5 weeks. But I averaged 3 days for a jury trial. It was going to take something like 85 years to try every case.
Wow.
With every courtroom going.
85 years.
Yeah, it's impossible. And so, unfortunately, plea negotiations are a necessary part of what we do.
One thing I've noticed, too, and have had some of the judges in charge of these talking about it, do you see any benefit from, like, we have drug court, we have veterans court. Are those helping some?
Those have huge benefits. Our mental health court, drug court, veterans court for appropriate offenders.
I've heard some pretty good stories of, like, because these people just need to be directed the right way, and we can get some benefit.
Right, and the whole idea of that is to identify the right people, fix the problem that is contributing to them living a life of crime. We fix that problem, whether it's addiction, it's PTSD, it's a mental health issue, and then they don't reoffend. And we've seen that happen since we started these courts 2-3 years ago. Drug court's been around forever.
Right. Veterans court and mental health.
Judge Jennifer Wright revolutionized it a couple of years ago. It's saving hundreds of thousands of dollars in nights spent in jail, in nights spent in inpatient treatment. It's good for the community,
and we're seeing them not re-arrested. As a district attorney, you're a thumbs up on it. You think it's a good thing?
I am. When it's done the right way and we're able to identify the right candidates, I'm a huge proponent of those because it reduces crime. And I'm for anything that's going to reduce crime and make our community safer.
Good to hear. All right. We'll come back more with District Attorney Keith Blackwood. Also, thank you, Cheese Wagon. We'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:53 FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. We're adjacent to Deep Graw right now tonight. The Incas get rolling. Some will argue tonight starts, really last night starts Deep Graw. Everybody else is saying, I'm kind of like Stripers Thursday night starts the Deep Graw. But we'll have that conversation on the text line as well. You got to park down there too. What do you think? When's it?
I think Deep Graw is probably right now. I went to the parade last night. The two biggest parades of the year are this afternoon, and that's my two youngest kids' preschool parades.
Okay.
So that's where I'm headed after this.
They go throw big time?
Oh, yeah, big time. The two-year-old, we've been working on her arm strength.
It's good stuff.
It's going to be good.
I did one of those with my kids when they were young, and they whipping the beads around, and then imagine they hit themselves. Then we had a crying thing. And I'm like, there's no crying at Mardi Gras. Come on. All right. Pat says, if the judges would stop letting criminals walk and get out early, y'all would probably have a lot less cases. I don't know. They got to come for you first, don't they?
Well, our judges, they are elected officials. They have hard decisions to make. We don't always agree, but I always respect their decisions. And, what I've seen here over the last few years is that we've been able to hold more and more people without bail due to Anaya's law, due to our judges following the law on some cases where they're on bond or on probation. We've had a lot of success, and our judges have done a good job, locking up some of the most violent offenders in jail awaiting trial. And that's a big difference that I've seen over the course of my career. Right now, there's been a huge improvement in that, and I commend the bench for that.
Yeah, I ask you this. Every time we've talked since the law passed, good tool for you? You use it?
That's a great tool. We use it. We're careful about how we do it because we want the bench to know that we're serious about
it. Right. You don't come in every case and go Anaya's law with it.
Yeah. If we did that, then that puts 100% of the decision on a judge who might not know all of the facts that I or my prosecutors know. And so, you know, we've built a relationship where, you know, when we ask for it and we present the evidence and meet that burden, they know that we mean it. And we've been very successful using an Nye's Law.
Break back in here, but more on that accident here. We've got a flipped SUV there at the 33-mile marker, overturned vehicle blocking. So eastbound Bayway, 33-mile marker out there. And we'll give you more updates coming up next hour with this. All right, as we wrap it up here, looking to the vote on Tuesday, right, for city council?
Right.
And this would be, and I do understand what you're saying, 3 years, because if it's 1 year, you're spending your time, I'm putting words in your mouth, you can tell me if you spit them back out, but you're spending time trying to figure out what's going to happen next year versus doing DA stuff.
Right, and I'd love to be able to do DA stuff. I would love for our prosecutors to feel like there's some stability so that they can do what they do. You know, the last thing I want is to lose a ton of experienced prosecutors and you know, bring in too many people fresh out of law school all at the same time with no institutional knowledge. If that's something we have to do, then that's something we have to do. But there are going to be a lot of fallout from that that I don't think would be good for our community.
But it is analogous, it seems to be, looking at law enforcement. Because when law enforcement, they'll go to a different department or something, or go out, and you're like, gosh, they knew a lot of stuff about, you know, they were more efficient of a police officer than, nothing wrong with the new guy or gal, but yeah, they're not as efficient as the person that's been there.
Yeah, it just comes with experience, being on the job. And you know, the fresh out of law school lawyers that we hire, you know, we hope to build them up into the greatest prosecutors ever. And, you know, we're able to bring them along. But what we don't want to do is lose a ton of institutional experience all at the same time. I don't think that would be good.
All right, and I have not been able to study it from what you do, but I have watched it with police officers, and they just know, well, this is going to happen because this happened. I'm like, how do you know? They said, watch. I'm like, oh, okay, you're right.
That's what happens.
Yep. Because they know how it happens. A couple questions here about getting in touch with your office. If somebody, this one's on a resolution on a bad check or this, that, how do they like get in touch with y'all?
So our phone number is 251-574-8400. That'll get you to the receptionist, and she can farm those out wherever they go. You can also email, if you go to our website, it's www.mobileda.org. There's an email address on there. I want to say it's info@mobileda.org, but check the website. It should be pretty obvious on there.
And if y'all ever, seriously, if you got a question like that, you can text me here on the text line, and I can you know, get something over to the DA's office, and we'll get you the answer. Thanks for being in here.
Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it.
And I'll see you again soon. We're coming right back. Hour number two of Midday Mobile. So they get a series of speakers at Gulf Quest, at Gulf Maritime Museum. And this is the second installment for this year. And yes, did it get my attention? Yes, it did, because it's about shipwrecks. And you know, I love this discussion. Not just the shipwrecks we've talked about in Mobile Bay. Think about them up and down the Florida coast. Dr. Della Arrington is going to join us here in just minutes to talk about it. Plus, in the second half of next hour, Johnny Hatcher joins us, all straight ahead.
There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan.
My brother from another mother.
On FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have y'all along. And the phone number, same as it ever was. But if you're new around here, that's cool. Area code. That was my New Year's resolution. Start using the area code. And I've done very good at this. 251-343-0000. 0106. 251-343-0106 gets you through. Also, with the FM Talk 106.5 app, you can leave us a talkback message. If you look at the microphone icon on the app, if you press it, lets you record a message, emails it to the show, and it can play it back here on the air. So now you got contact for this hour. And big thank you to Mobile County District Attorney Keith Blackwood for joining us in the last hour. I mentioned at the beginning of the show I was going to get to talk about shipwrecks with somebody who knows a lot about them. And pretty exciting, too, because you're going to be able to listen to her speak here, and she'll tell us about this coming up here in town. Joining us with a credential list that needs probably a 3x5 card for a business card, with a master's degree, PhD, and you did this in multiple practices. It's Dr. Della Scott Ireton. School was obviously a thing you're really good at, because your degree list is fantastic. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Because you start off this, and you're there at the University of West Florida, right? And this is...
Yes, that's right.
And so you come out of there with a bachelor's degree, like, you know, people come out with a bachelor's degree, and you do it in anthropology, but that's not enough. You get a master's degree in historical archaeology. So that wasn't enough. You get an international relations degree from Troy, and then you decide to get a doctorate in anthropology from Florida State. Impressive, Dr. Ireton, Scott Ireton. This is something. So what led you to start this journey, getting a bachelor's degree in anthropology? Is this something you just fell into in college, or you knew you always wanted to do something like this?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to be an archaeologist. I kind of laughingly tell my friends, you know, I never really wanted to be, you know, a veterinarian or a nurse or a teacher or, you know, the kinds of things that, you know, young kids often want to go mm-hmm. into. When I was a small child, my father read me the How and Why Wonder Book of Lost Civilizations. And being an archaeologist is all I ever wanted to do. And in the very back of that book, and that would have been in the, you know, early mid-70s, the very back page of that book was, you know, an archaeologist are now venturing into, you know, a previously inaccessible areas in the deep sea. And there was a picture of a diving archaeologist in the Mediterranean. And I used to just sit and just stare at that picture and think that was the coolest thing in the world. Learning about ancient civilizations and doing it while diving. And then my parents are always so totally supportive. You know, they never looked at me and said, that's crazy. You'll never find a job in that. Go do something worthwhile. My dad was a historian and army officer. And so he was always very, very supportive. And so they encouraged me and they gave me dive lessons for my high school graduation. And then I was very fortunate to be here in Pensacola, near where Daddy retired, and was able to go to school at UWF and was a part of their very first maritime archaeology field school back in the summer of 1989. And so was very fortunate to be able to carry on doing that and to study it at the master's level and then at the PhD level at Florida State. So I've been super lucky and being so supported by my family and friends throughout my career.
It's cool getting certified there in high school. Yeah, I did one of my certification dives over at Fort Pickens. I was the same thing. I was probably 85 or so doing that. But I just got to do it on a lark. You get to do it as a job. You're a maritime archaeologist, right? That's if we had to put all that into one, a maritime archaeologist. What do you do? Like if somebody says maritime archaeologist, what's your Monday look like?
What in the world does that mean? Basically, it's archaeology. So it's a study of past peoples and cultures, primarily through the things they left behind. But with historical archaeology, we also have written documents. That's the history part. And so as a maritime archaeologist, I primarily study the way people have interacted with the water, whether it's oceans, rivers, lakes, bays, you know, that kind of thing. I'm very interested in how people have used water through the centuries, the eons, as much more of a bridge than a barrier. And the watercraft that transported them, the infrastructure that it takes to load everything on board a ship and move it somewhere else and offload it and trade it for something else, or to carry war, or to carry whatever ships carried. They carried so many things. So that's what always has fascinated me. And so I've studied watercraft, In particular, the colonial era in the United States and North America has always been very fascinating to me. But then right on up to more modern watercraft, and then sharing that with the public. That's where my work with the Florida Public Archaeology Network has been so special to me, is that I get to share that love with people, other people who are also interested.
I'm thinking about it. This is just musing here. You're the pro in this, but people put things, maybe a higher density. If you're doing a, you know, if you're doing archaeology work and you're doing a city or an area, it could be spread out. But people put all the stuff that was valuable to them in one thing, in a ship, right? I mean, it was like a density of things to find, right, for an archaeologist. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair. You're spot on, Sean. And it's, you know, we think of ships as kind of microcosms or little time capsules of the cultures that created them, that the people who sailed on them, who built them, who wrecked on them, who sometimes died on them, and the things that they left behind on board ship. And unlike land archaeological sites, which can build up in layers over time, and it can be very difficult to determine what object came from what culture when, with a shipwreck, it's often kind of one catastrophic moment in time. We do see some places around the world where ships kind of tend to build up shipwrecks, ship traps, you know, mm-hmm, reefs or shoals that collect kind of, you know, ships that have gone astray. But in most cases, shipwrecks are this one catastrophic moment in time. And we know that everything on board that ship was in use by the people on that ship at that time. And so it really is a way to kind of study this one moment and know that these people were using these things, they were carrying these things to other places to trade for something they didn't have or to start a new way of life or whatever, you know, whatever the purpose of that ship was. And so it's really a neat way to be able to study the past through the objects.
Yeah, you think he's talking about ship traps and shoals and places that maybe collect more, but this is what's so exciting is, you ask people about shipwrecks, I'm guessing this is just from, they'll go, oh, the Caribbean, that's where you go. Mm-hmm. But over conversations over the years with our friend in common, John Sledge and others, right here at home, we got the shipwrecks. You don't have to travel the Caribbean.
Exactly. We have some fantastic shipwrecks right here along the Gulf Coast. The Caribbean is great. You know, I'd love to go to the Caribbean and study and dive for fun. You know, it's beautiful, clear mm-hmm. water, and there's lots of pretty critters that live on the shipwrecks
like
as well.
I like it too, yes.
Yeah, but right here we have fantastic shipwrecks. And often in our bay systems, like here in Pensacola Bay or what you have there in Mobile Bay, the water's kind of dark. The bottom of the bay is muddy. It's not the best diving, but it's fantastic for preserving shipwrecks. That mud in the bottom of our bays is an anaerobic environment, which means there's no oxygen, so therefore there's no bacteria. So even really fragile organic remains that we don't often find on land sites, we can find on these submerged sites. And so it offers a really a fascinating and detailed glimpse into our past.
So, yeah, so give me an idea of that preservation from mud. If you took whatever structure, we'll have the structure of a ship, and we're going to put that, we're going to put that on land, okay, and we're going to start the, we turn the hourglass over and let the sand start running through, and then we put it encased in mud, you know, in a bay system, estuary mm-hmm. system. How much longer, I mean, I know everything's site-specific, but are we mm-hmm. looking at 10-fold, 50-fold time preserved versus it being on land somewhere?
Hundreds of years in some cases. For example, here in Pensacola, we have the remains of the Tristan da Cunha expedition shipwrecks, and that dates from 1559, one of the earliest Spanish colonization efforts in what is today the United States. It's why Pensacola likes to call itself the first place city. And so we found three of the shipwrecks from that expedition, and the University of West Florida has been working on those for quite a long time. And they're buried in the bottom of the mud in the bottom of Pensacola Bay. And so the ship structure itself is beautifully preserved, the wood, which would have never lasted on land. We also find things like cockroach wings and rat bones and
what?
Leather shoe soles. Yeah, it's incredible.
That's
things.
Preserved like.
Yes.
So it's not just, I mean, because I think about the preservation, I'm thinking about the ribs of a ship or something like that, or mm-hmm. obviously metal, you know, cannonade or something like that, but actual critters.
Critters, absolutely, yes. The remains, I mentioned the black rat. It's the earliest evidence of the black rat in North America. We're very proud of that here in Pensacola.
Oh, thanks, Pensacola.
Yeah,
thank you.
Right? But these amazing preservation, the remains of the bones of foodstuffs, you know, like cattle bones and sheep or goat, you know, that were butchered and carried for provisions. But we've also found the remains of one of the ship's cats, which unfortunately died in the hurricane that sunk the ships. And so wonderfully well preserved that one of my colleagues here at UWF, Dr. John Bratton, was able to send those bones off for DNA analysis. We know that the cat was a gray tabby. Amazing stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah. So think about the technology here, you know, to be able to figure out it's a gray tabby from genetics. What about finding shipwrecks? Like, we've got a bunch of shipwrecks we know of, right, in our region. Mm-hmm. But are you finding new shipwrecks? Is there technology that helps us find ones that maybe we didn't know of?
Absolutely. And we use that technology all the time. Some of the best ways to find shipwrecks is talking to people. Honestly, you know, here around our bays and on offshore, we have a long history, of course, of shrimpers and fisher people and, you know, people who have been working their whole lives on the bays and the coastal areas. And they'll tell us, you know, where they get their nets hung or the places that they avoid so they don't get, you know, the damage to their fishing gear. And often, sometimes it's just piles of trash or, you know, whatever, but sometimes it's a shipwreck. We also utilize more high-tech instruments, things like magnetometers, which are essentially like a giant metal detector you tow behind a boat. And you have a computer that sits on the boat, and anytime the sensor head, we call it the fish, runs over something of a ferrous metal, which is iron metal on the bottom, it'll let us know that something is there. We also have side scan sonar, which also you tow behind the boat. It looks kind of like a torpedo getting towed behind the boat. We've actually had Marine Patrol called on us before.
But it's because they thought you were finding our snapper spot. That's what they thought.
Exactly. But a side scan will give you basically an acoustic image of what's on the bottom. So it looks almost like a photograph in some cases. And so those are some of the ways that archaeologists find shipwrecks.
Now, in these shipwrecks, too, you're talking about the things you find, but of course, we maybe buried the lead for most people. I'm fascinated by the fact you found animal remains and all that, but treasure. You know, people always, the shipwreck equals equals treasure. What about, right? I mean, you've gotten that doing what you do for a living. People say, what kind of treasure you find? What do you find in the shipwrecks here? Any treasure?
Absolutely. Yeah, it does. That turns up a lot. You know, I think because of a lot of the you know, stories people see in the media that kind of tends to hype up, you know, Spanish treasure and pirate booty and that kind of thing. And we all sort of laugh. Archaeologists sort of laugh. That is so rare, number one. And number two, it's very uninteresting to archaeologists. So we'd much rather find broken ceramics and rat bones and cockroach wings because that tells us what the people are doing. That's the difference in archaeology and treasure hunting. Treasure hunters are going after shiny things that they can sell for personal gain. Archaeologists are going after knowledge. And so a coin doesn't tell us a whole lot other than when that coin was minted. The other things can tell us what people were doing, how they were living, what parts of their culture were they translating onto ship that were then carried to other places. So that's really what archaeologists are getting at, is the past peoples and what they were doing and how they were living, not so much the shiny things that they were carrying.
How do you protect your archaeology archaeology site? Because I think about this, like a friend of mine and a group of folks try to protect it. Wants everybody to see these 50,000-year-old cypress stumps that are out off south of Baldwin County. But the worry is, until there's some bigger protection, having those GPS coordinates out there, because people could take some of that. What about the shipwrecks? Is there issue of protecting those things so you can go back and study them? Is there anything that governs that?
Absolutely, there is. In the United States, shipwrecks in federal waters are protected by what's called the Abandoned Shipwreck Act, which was signed into federal law in 1988. And basically what that does is declare that all shipwrecks, historic shipwrecks, in around the waters of the United States are protected from unauthorized salvage or looting or collecting of artifacts. And that law then turns over protection of those shipwrecks to the states in whose waters they are embedded. And so that gives the states the jurisdiction to protect their shipwrecks. And most coastal states have state-level laws as well. In Florida, we have the Florida Historical Resources Act, which protects archaeological sites on land as well as in Florida's sovereignty submerged lands. So just like it makes it illegal to go and, you know, collect a brick out of Mount Vernon or a bullet from the Gettysburg battlefield, it also is unlawful to collect anything from a historic shipwreck. And even as archaeologists, we have to get the proper permitting on the state level, sometimes on the federal level, to in order to investigate these shipwrecks. And then it also comes with agreements that artifacts will be conserved and then go on display or be made available for study. You know, they don't disappear into private collections. On a more practical level, we rely a lot on education. A lot of people tend to think that, oh, if something is underwater, it's up for grabs. And nothing could be further from the truth. And so we do a whole lot of educating of people to explain that sites underwater are protected just like sites on land are protected. And for most people, once they learn that and learn what it is that archaeologists are after, the value of the science and the value of the education and the learning, most people get that. You know, there's always going to be people who commit vandalism. There's always going to be people who break into your car. It's real hard to educate those people. But the vast majority of folks, they get into the science and the history and the learning.
Well, Dr. Scott Ireton, you kind of put the ball on the tee for me. Perfect segue. So people want to get the education. You got an event coming up the 19th, I think, right? Right here in Mobile.
That is correct. Yeah, I've gotten the wonderful invitation from the Museum of the Gulf here in there in Mobile for the 19th of February at noon, a part of their Gulf Chat series, and I'll be there talking about shipwrecks of Northwest Florida. So I invited everybody to come out and hear what little bit I have to say, and I'm always happy to answer questions and provide more information.
It's fascinating. Hope to see you then, and I appreciate you being on the show, and good luck finding more shipwrecks, and then come back and talk to me about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Sean. It'd be my pleasure. And thank you again for having me on.
Hey, thanks for being on. Dr. Della Scott Ireton out of the University of West Florida. She's going to be here in Mobile coming up February 19th. More details, we'll put them up on our Facebook page, and we'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 126 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along, and a good time to check in with my buddy Blaine at Parrish Tractor, or maybe delivering something. I don't know, are you at the shop, or are you out delivering? What are you doing, man?
I'm on the road today, Sean.
See?
It's Friday, and we're getting equipment out of here, so I'm on the road today.
Yeah, you've talked about that, too. Somebody wants to do a rental with y'all, how that works. I mean, it could be, you know, smaller equipment that goes in a backyard, or somebody like me that needs a skid steer. How does that work?
Yeah, so you can just give us a call. We can line that up, or you can come by and see us. We do offer delivery, pickup and delivery. We got trailers to go with most of our equipment, or you can bring your own trailer. So, but that works on all of our tractors, skid steers, mini excavators. We do offer dump trailers, scissor lifts, all the way down to hand tools. So if you're in the market, you know, you're not ready to buy something yet, a certain type of equipment that you're looking at, want to try it out, rental's a great option. Rent for a weekend or just a day, and try it out. But if you do have that one special job that there's, you know, no reason to ever purchase that piece of equipment for that one specific job, just come rent it from us. We'll be happy to take care of you.
And on the flip side, you and I joked about this earlier in the week, but Lord knows it's true. We're going to wake up very soon. It's going to be mowing time again. You and I both mow a lot. Y'all got a great selection on mowers.
We do. So we're fully stocked right now on all of our gas and diesel models and our zero turns, the Kubota zero turns. Ranging from 42 up to 72 inch in deck sizes. Kubota's still offering the zero interest financing. And another option there is we're just talking about rental. We do have zero turns in our rental fleet. So, you know, if you want to try one out, you know, for a week, a weekend, a day, come rent it from us. Try it out for yourself, see how it works. And then, you know, we have guys all the time that maybe they pick up a piece of property that is just a little too large for their fleet of mowers, and they need one extra mower. They'll come by and rent it for the day or the weekend to knock out that piece of property. So we got a little bit of everything in stock right now, so come by and see us here at Parrish Tractor in Robertsdale.
All right, and then the website, if they want to go there, because you got a lot of stuff on there to look at, how do they find that?
We do. You can go on our website. You can check out all of our new and used inventory. That is at parishtracker.com.
All right. Good stuff, Blaine. Have a great weekend. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Sean. You too.
All right. There goes Blaine at Parish Tractor. Hey, coming up here in a couple of minutes, we'll go to the news and come back. And I think Mobile County School Board, Johnny Hatcher, a member, Johnny Hatcher, is going to join us. I don't know if you followed this today. This story, this update from LanyapMobile.com said, though the Mobile County Public School System called off U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon's visit to Murphy High School, dozens of students and community members protested her and President Donald Trump's administration at the Midtown Mobile School anyway. Protest at Murphy and commentary. We come back with Johnny Hatcher right here on Midday Mobile.
Automotive, and we're in a new year, but great sales still going on those 2025 models.
That's right. We got half tons, three quarter tons, and one tons. Got some regular cabs and a half ton. Got a couple of three quarter ton diesel four wheel drive crew cabs. Everybody likes those SLTs. And the one ton is a couple of regular cabs. Anybody needs something for a work, we got it over there. So just check us out online at McConnellAutomotive.com or give us a call at 251-476-4141.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 135, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Friday. Great time to check in with my friend Anna at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. And should we just call it Silver City for now on? What do you think, Anna?
No, I wouldn't say that. But it is down to about $80. It's just under $80 right now. And it's slowly been climbing. Actually, yesterday, after we closed, it actually did drop into the 60s. And then this morning, it climbed back into the 70s. And it's going to be hitting 80 soon if it keeps climbing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we've talked about, like, there'll be a news story, say, well, and pick the precious metal, gold or silver, down 1.3% in intraday trading. And I go, okay. What was it this time last year? I mean, that's what we're talking about. I mean, it is appreciated big time.
Oh, yeah. I think it was probably in the 20s or 30s, yeah. I want to say.
I'd love my stocks to do like that. If my stocks would, like, triple in value, I'd be okay with that. I'd be cool with that.
I think we all would be okay with that.
It'd be a great thing. So, and obviously, people coming to y'all and buying everything from the rounds to the bars and everything in silver, yeah, and gold. But y'all also, you were talking about this the other day, y'all are buying silver yourself. So if somebody's got a bar or a round they want to sell,
oh yeah,
you're buying.
Absolutely. Yep, we're buying silver, and we're selling silver as well. A lot of people are rushing right now that it took a dip to buy some more silver before it goes back up again.
Yeah, I mean, that's a buy on the dips. It's the smart move. Also, I mean, you have those sales going on in gold, and I thought about this the other day, too. We had talked about it. You brought it up, months ago. But for people who are looking for a smaller, they're like, oh, my gosh, gold, you know, is valued like this. Y'all sell, is the right term gold back that you have that – smaller denomination of what is that the right term for it?
Yeah, that's correct. It's called a gold back, and it's basically a small fractional piece of gold, and it's in a thin sheet. It's almost like currency. I don't know how else to put it. It's like a thin sheet of gold that you can buy, and it's like one of a thousandth or one of two thousandths of a troy ounce of gold.
So if somebody wants to, like, get in at that level, that's a great way to do it as well. So the key here is to tell people how to find you, how to come out and check out what's going on with precious metals and everything else in the shop.
Absolutely. We're at 2204 Government Street on this beautiful Midtown sunny day, and you can call us at 251-725-1590 if you want to call and check in before you make a trip up here.
All right. Thank you, Anna. We'll talk to you next week.
You're welcome.
All right, there goes Anna at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. And Mobile County School Board member Johnny Hatcher joining us in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you for having me.
This is, the story's been popping up. I don't know how many people have seen it. This is one of these stories will be a bigger story by Monday.
Oh, I can imagine.
But I'm glad we're, you know, doing what we do and you reaching out to me to talk about it today. Yeah, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show and then just before you came in. Mobile County's public school system called off U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon's visit to Murphy High School. Now, she's in town. You met with her.
I did.
Explain how all this went down. Give me a timeline here.
Roughly about a month ago, Sean, her people reached out to the central office and made them aware that they were selected. We were the only system in the state of Alabama. We got picked for them to come here and do History Rocks. And it's a really
this
good
program.
This
is the thing they're doing across select schools
doing
across
it
the country.
In 50 states.
Okay, so just...
So we were very fortunate to get it. And it was going to showcase Mobile County Public Schools, all the great things we've done, everything. They hadn't got a word back after 2 weeks. I talked to the superintendent. After they reached out to me, the superintendent says, there is no way I'm not going to let the Secretary of Education not come to our schools. Set everything up. Yesterday, I got a call wanting to talk, so we talked.
From the Fed side or from the school?
From the superintendent.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Apologize. From the superintendent wanting to talk. So we had a conversation. In that conversation, he said that there was going to be a lot of protesting from students, teachers, and things like that, and he felt like that it would be better to postpone it.
But you can't postpone it because this is when they're in town, right?
Buddy, they were coming.
Well, she's
they were
here
yesterday.
Yeah, she was here. So
yeah, they were here yesterday. They had already made the arrangements and everything. So it really wasn't fair to them. So,
so follow a timeline. So they make the request. So Secretary of Education's office makes a request.
Yes.
Then there goes a period of time where there's no response.
No response.
A couple weeks, maybe.
A couple weeks.
Okay. Then there's a response. And it's okay, we're going to do this. We're going to have, because it's the History Rocks thing. It's not a political thing. It's about history.
Look, I was at it today. They had it at Satsuma.
Okay.
Their system was gracious enough to host them. And let me tell you something. They had 14 hours. We had a month. They knocked it out of the park. You hear me?
Go Gators.
They did an exceptional job. Them Gators. Man, I tell you what, I was very impressed and very humbled that they would invite me. And just they did a really good job. And I wanted to go because I really wanted to see what the talk was about because I was told that it's a political deal. Let me tell you something. It's far from political. There was no politics in there whatsoever. And there was concerns that because maybe that they were sponsored by Turning Point.
Yeah.
That was a concern. Let me tell you something. They never mentioned Turning Point. They never put any propaganda for anything or any sponsors whatsoever on that property. There was never mentioned. There was nothing to do. There was no hidden agenda. It was 100% about history. And I'm going to tell you something. The kids loved it. They eat it up. And it was a historical moment that we missed out on.
Yeah, that it ended up not with the place they wanted to come, Murphy High School.
They wanted to come to us. They wanted to come here and showcase our system.
In the Mobile County Public School System.
Man, wouldn't that have been great?
And the school system said no. I mean, is that fair enough? Even though you said the superintendent said yes, but at the end of it,
at the 11th hour, yes, it was a no.
Said no.
Wanted to reschedule. The thing is, you know, if she's willing to come and she's already made all these plans, preparations, we should allow it to happen. We should accommodate. Now, Sean, understand this. We had some misfortunate events as of late with some shootings. That didn't stop me or my family going to watch my nephew play basketball at the same place where all the misfortunate events occurred.
Mm-hmm.
We beefed up security. We took the necessary precautions. These things could have been handled. These things should have been handled.
But the denial,
out on a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, but the denial. Help me understand this. The denial here was not because the school said something about security.
No.
For the secretary.
No.
It wasn't that.
No.
It was that they needed to reschedule because
the protesting.
Because the protest.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think if you want to teach history. You're seeing it. You teach history inside. If people protest outside, they're exercising First Amendment rights.
Sean,
that's part of our history.
They did it anyway.
Yeah, I saw that.
What happened? What did
the protest still happened?
Nothing we did stopped it. We allowed them to essentially tell us that we couldn't have it in our system.
The
protesters.
That's my question. Right. So the reasoning was, I'm making sure, I'm stepping lightly here so I get what actually happened. Johnny, the reason given for denying the Secretary of Education coming to Murphy High School was that there was going to be a protest.
That's exactly what it was.
And there still was a protest anyway.
And there was still a protest anyway. Listen, she just come, yesterday she was in Chicago. They had protesters there. She went anyway. She was not going to be extorted or intimidated by anyone. she still went to Chicago. Chicago hosted her. They said they would do it, and they followed through with it.
But Mobile
did not.
We should have
done the same thing. No, we didn't.
Chicago, y'all.
Chicago. Let me tell you something.
Did it, but Mobile County Public School System did not.
No. It's very disheartening.
There's so many questions come up in my mind and on the text line. Ben asking, if the person they were protesting wasn't there, then why didn't the people in charge at Murphy tell the kids to get their butts back in class? And was it only students and staff in those photos, or were there people that weren't supposed to be on a school campus that just showed up to protest?
My God, that's a great question.
Because aren't there rules about who can be on a school campus?
Absolutely, but they wasn't on the campus. I talked to Andy Gatewood, head of security. Andy's a wonderful guy, does a great job. I'm very proud of Andy and his staff. They do a tremendous job protecting these children and faculty. Now, let me say this. When I talked to Andy told me, I said, Andy, please tell me they wasn't on our property. Because it kind of looks like that.
And he says, right. Yeah, I couldn't tell from
there. Yeah, he says, no, they were not. They were on the walkways. And some of the students that were there were not allowed to re-enter back into the school.
Okay. So once they were, okay.
Once they, yes.
Jason texts in and says, Sean, Mr. Hatcher, and anyone involved in this should be highly ashamed of themselves. Who would ever pass on an opportunity for that recognition and possible opportunities it could bring? Hopefully he's apologetic and recognizes this blunder. This should cost the superintendent his job.
Well, I'm one of five, to be honest with you. So it's going to take more than just Mr. Hatcher to do anything. But what I will tell you is I was apologetic to Ms. McMahon when I spoke to her today. And I will tell you, she's very gracious and very kind. Now, this woman who sits as a secretary of education also handles billions of dollars of educational funds that could potentially have came right here to my district. So I ask her, please do not hold that against us. And if it makes you feel any better and you want to make sure it goes to the right place, send it to District 5, earmark it.
So it's a way to represent your district.
Hey.
Butternice says, Sean, this is a great example that protesting works.
I think he's about as smart as the ones that were there today.
And let's see. John says, as a graduate of Murphy in 66, we were known nationally as a beautiful and top educational school. Mobile County School Board has totally screwed up this facility.
Well,
just words of the text. Squirrel said there was no protest from the live. This is what you're referencing.
Let me make it clear now. This was a decision made by the superintendent.
Who represents the school board?
Who represents the school board. The school board had input. I had input. Others had input. I can't discuss what others' input was.
Is there a record of the vote? Is there a vote or something?
No, there was not a vote. He runs day-to-day operations. He handles that. So ultimately, it lies upon him. But he did reach out and speak with all the school board commissioners.
Squirrel Vereen says there was no protest from the libs about the shooting, which you referenced earlier. Mobile County Public School System needs to know.
Well, they don't really care about that, do they?
Needs
these
to
protesters.
Stop.
Yeah. These wonderful protesters that this gentleman spoke about was speaking highly of. Let me just tell you this. How about they protest something that actually matters? How about they do that? How about
Adam asked. What the hell were they protesting about to read his text? What were they protesting?
The fact that she was coming here and that she's part of Trump's cabinet. That's it. That's all it is to it. And, well, I'll be honest with you, and it had to do with Turning Point, because Turning Point was a...
But this is how... Okay, so this is a fair question, trying to look at both sides of this. Was there... We weren't the first stop on this, right?
In Alabama, yes, sir.
No, but I'm saying in other states.
Oh, other states, yeah, it's been...
So
yes.
It was a known commodity that Turning Point wasn't part of the... wasn't part of the material.
Yes.
The material was known material.
Yes.
You could go to another state where she had been before and say, what's the presentation? Let's look at the presentation.
Turning Point had no involvement. But let me just tell you this, and I'll make this clear, and really don't care what anybody thinks about me about this, but I wouldn't care if Turning Point... was part of it. I think they're a great organization.
I get that from the politics, but I'm just saying but to talk facts here.
Yeah, they had nothing.
They could have
it.
Gone, this wasn't an unknown thing. You could say, what happened in the previous stop for the secretary, Secretary McMahon? Okay, here was the presentation. Now you know what the presentation is, and it's what you said. It was nothing but just regular history.
Yes.
but it was exciting and all that. That
it was amazing.
It was a known thing. So the issue was, at least this angle, is that one of the sponsors that pays for this is Turning Point.
Yes. Now, let me just say this. If Black Lives Matter wants to sponsor anything to do that we are approving, that we approve as far as history, legitimate, you know, this is your the history was presidential history. It was your separation from Britain, your civil wars, things like that. If they want to come and do something like that and sponsor it, I welcome their money. Mm-hmm. Please come bring it. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with their monies. But they're not going to come and push their agenda, no more than I'm going to let anybody else do it. And right. I like Turning Point. I really do. But I'm but not going to let them. It's not a platform for them to do that.
And that was known. That was known before it came here.
Yes.
That it was not a platform.
Yes.
Okay. Hang out for a second with me. Sure. Go to the news. Come right back. More with Johnny Hatcher. Our guest right here, 251-343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 153 FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Time to check in with my buddy David McCrary at LCM Motor Cars. And you and I were talking during the news break about pre-approvals. Talk about how that works at LCM.
I will. We got work trucks out here, too. So I just wanted to, you know, that previous commercial you got me. We got a ton of work trucks. But anyway, pre-approvals. I know it's tax time and all that, and people are out looking and trying to figure out what they're going to do, where they're going to do it. Everybody knows that everything you buy from us at LCM's got a warranty. Everybody knows that we check our cars and try to make sure that whatever we're selling is a great car. You can go online to our website and do some information, or you can come by here in person and do it, and we can go ahead and get you pre-approved if you're waiting for your tax check to come in. Sometimes we can go ahead and get you in the car before your tax check gets here. So if you're looking and you're not sure what you want, just don't go blowing around everywhere. Come by, see us. Let us see if we can get you approved, and or we can get you approved. There's no doubt about that. And we'll tell you what you need to bring to us and make it work. Make it work.
All right. Well, tell them how to find you.
We're at Highway 90 and Plantation in Theodore. It's 1 mile south of I-10, exit 15A. You can give us a call at 251-375-0068. Or go to the website. It's one place you can go in there and get pre-approved. It's lcmmotorcars.com.
Thanks, David.
All right, buddy. Have a good day.
You too. There he goes, David at LCM. Continue for a few more minutes here before we, Paul Feinbaum takes over on us, Johnny. But Johnny Hatcher, Mobile County Public School Board member. Get back to the text line here. I got my questions, but I got tons from the listeners as well. Alan says, how board members, superintendents, etc., vote on things like this, and the details of what's said should be a matter of public record so they can be held accountable.
Well, it's something you don't vote on. Again, the superintendent,
so it's not a vote.
No, the superintendent handles day-to-day operations. That was that's within his wheelhouse. So we don't do that. We don't micromanage.
You know, the protest here seemed pretty organized too. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, isn't that something? It's amazing how children can come together and be that well organized. It would appear to me that they had some help.
Yeah, in the article, I read an article from Lanyap, and it said the folks with Indivisible Mobile were talking about, they said that it was a student plan protest that was planned long before McMahon announced her visit. I said it was a student initiative. I don't know why. How you would
bull crap?
Yeah, don't get me a fine.
Bull crap. I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, Jason said, do we know if the protesters were the Indivisible group led by Moore Mandike or that organizes the No Kings, Free Palestine, etc.? She commented on it in the Lanyap story. I don't know. She didn't admit to. She said in this quote here, "This is a student initiative. They reached out to us a couple days ago and said they wanted to do this, and they hope to have support from Indivisible Mobile and other community members." We said absolutely. So,
yeah, that sounds plausible. Not,
but the fact that they had planned it long ago, I don't.
What are they protesting? I mean, what do they know about that? What is it that they want to protest? These are kids. Come on, what is so bad about history?
Well, and this is me trying to think through this, and if I'm on the school board, and I'm worried about that there's going to be commercial messaging for Turning Point in there, or there's going to be something that's political and not historical, then my job, I think, and I don't know your job, but I think I would say, hey, y'all, send me the link here so I can watch the presentation.
We were told it was vetted. I was told it was vetted. And I was told that it was...
Because it had happened in other states before it got here.
So that's why I went today, and because I was invited as well, but went today...
Because it happened in Satsuma today.
Absolutely. It happened in Satsuma. They had 14 hours, and they pulled it off, and it was a absolute wonderful event. The children were ecstatic. Let me tell you something. Bruce Pearl spoke to the children. This was a historical event. And let me tell you something. It's shameful that adults are conditioning these children to do these things, and that's all it is.
The kids could have still done a protest, and the school system could have still had the event.
But that's right, and that's a great
point. Two things
point.
Could happen.
That's a great point. They had it anyway, because they were, anyway, I don't want to get into that. I will say this. There's no way that these children done this on their own. There's no way. They have no idea what they're out there protesting. I assure you of that.
Okay. And music has started, means we've got to finish up, but I'm sure there's going to be more to talk about.
Let me just say this before we go. Yeah. My very good friend Josh Wood said, make sure I talk about what a great job he's doing in District 6.
Josh, that's going to cost you 20 for me. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this more next week, so come by and talk
Absolutely.
With us then. All right. Mobile School Board member Johnny Hatcher and Paul Feinbaum takes over next. We'll see y'all tomorrow for FM Talk Outdoors.